We're going to go ahead and get started. First up, we have a presentation on IT integration efforts. And Dale, are you going to start? Oh, okay. Sorry.
Surprisingly, yeah. Okay, so on behalf of the Technology Steering Committee, which is made up of myself, Mark from RPU, Audrey from the library, Tim Harrell from the police department, and then Dale is sort of our, I guess, advisor. And then we also, which made up the steering committee, and then we also, as we'll discuss in just a second here, we also had more of a technical committee, and that was Terrell and Brent Marxison with City IT, Steve Mosin with the library, Phil Payne, and Peter Hogan from RPU. So those are the groups involved. But basically, as the quick background, we've been having the conversations about how we can better, within the city and within the various departments, share technology, make sure that our technology is interacting with it, with each department, all those sort of things. And so we formed this group to take a look at why have we not been maybe doing some of this in the past, what have the roadblocks been, those sort of things. So basically, just very quickly, what we're looking to do is just provide an update today and then kind of give you a little bit of a roadmap of where we're going in the future. The first thing obviously has been is that this has been something that's been looked at in the past. This is really nothing new. We have had years of sort of siloed separation for a number of different reasons, but you know, we have to say in working through this process, other departments do want to make this work. It's just that they all each have their unique needs, concerns, things like that, so we're trying to make sure we address those as we go through this. We did use the old McLadry study that was done. It provided us with kind of historical backgrounds and guidance and things like that, but it really was only guidance. We weren't basing any of our decisions or our actions on that study. And really, I think what did come out of all of it is the technology is kind of the technology, but it is we really need to develop the relationships between the departments to make sure that we can make this work. Everybody recognizes it's going to take some time, but we've made great progress here in the last few months, and everybody is committed to make sure that this keeps moving forward and we do get to a point where we think we should be with our technology. With that, what we've been trying to solve really is that we want to reduce that total cost of ownership for citywide technology. And we also then want to create that efficiencies so we could, by reducing the redundancy of departmental IT efforts. So basically, are we doing the same thing across departments? If we are, how are we going to address that so we don't do that anymore? If RPU is doing something, the same thing that PD is doing, the same thing that City Hall is doing, how can we reduce those sort of things? So really what we've kind of worked under is the basic principles that whatever ideas, solutions that we come up with, we don't want to compromise our current levels of customer service. And of course, the big thing, especially when you're talking about police and RPU, is regulatory compliance. We have to make sure we keep those levels where they're supposed to be. And it's really not about trying to centralize anything. We're not trying to say that we have to create one IT department or unit that's housed in one place that serves RPU, police, library, city, but it's more about just developing a consistent process and a consistent network, and that we leverage what everyone does for the best success for the city. So basically, the progress so far, we've had this technical committee, which I mentioned, which included the IT management from all the different departments that we're working with, and they've met a number of times over the last 3 months. And they've developed a recommended infrastructure option that will do the things that we've kind of talked about, even the small victories, like centralized email and calendaring, so we can send out a calendar notice, and a library can respond to that Outlook notice, and those sort of things, as well as the bigger things, the current future sharing of applications, and then leveraging what infrastructure we have across the whole city. So some of these things, I'm really basically just reading off a slide. I don't fully understand. If you have technical questions, we have plenty of people here that can answer those. But some of the early things that we definitely had to do was develop the citywide security policy. We have, as I mentioned before, a number of requirements. We've got NERC requirements with RPU. We've got the BCA requirements with the police department. We've got to make sure that we've got a security policy that addresses all those items. We need to implement security procedures. And then we need to talk about how do we pay for these things? What's the departmental budgets, the chargeback protocol, those sort of things. You can see the triangle sort of, I guess, idea there with the single force with multiple domains. And once again, if you have a question about that, we'll refer that to somebody else. The bigger part is the, not the bigger part, but the part that I guess maybe I was maybe more involved in directly than I actually understand, is the governance side of things. And that's where we talk about having this steering committee that's going to develop a process and policy so we can create consistencies where it's applicable across all these different IT functions. And then we also want this steering committee, this governance team, to kind of set a direction for continuing seeing this project basically forever. We want to really be able to leverage technology across the city in the most efficient way possible. And to do that, we feel it's important to have this kind of ongoing steering committee dealing with these technology issues. So what's our roadmap and where are we going? So this year, we're talking about a governance structure. How are we going to set it up so that we can review all these different ideas and things that come out of it, set up that citywide security policy, and then that last part is that procurement process. And the thing that we're looking for with that is with that steering committee is if one department wants to buy some semblance of calendaring, licensing, permitting, whatever the software might be, is there another city department that already has something that we could use in that department? Instead of going out and purchasing a separate standalone software system that IT then has to maintain and deal with, and we probably have to pay separate license fees for, are we not going through and making sure that some other department does not have the technology in place or ready that we could use for that department's needs? So, and then how do you review that? How do you make sure that it fits the right needs, and it, all those sort of things? And that's part of that governance that we're working on. The infrastructure, we're talking about the shared platform for applications, and then what are the applications? We need an inventory of all our applications, and then how do we implement the citywide security protocols? And then the staff support and competency. What needs do we have? What is the gap analysis? And then what's our budget? We need to establish a budget moving this forward. Now, obviously, the ultimate goal is that in long term, we're going to save the city money by consolidating the amount of software we have and creating efficiencies by utilizing all the different IT staff that we have already. But we need to lay this out. How are we going to do it? What is the budget for this? All those sort of things. We want to develop that budget. Next year, 2016, we want to work with the departmental business strategies so we can align the technology direction. So everybody knows that we're doing this. We're on the same page. Here's how we're kind of moving this forward. We want to set up, as far as the infrastructure, a platform for mobile device management. And then with the applications, as I talked before, is emailing. We want to work on the GIS. We want to, HR has a big function for their JDE and their self-service. And then, of course, for me, the electronic document management, one of the biggest reasons I'm involved is that technically I'm responsible for all the documents in the city. What's public? What's private? Are they being released or not? How are they being retained and stored? And there's no way for me to do that right now with our electronic documents. And then, of course, for the staff, it's a training and education plan. We've identified where our gaps are, how do we fill those gaps moving forward. And then 2017, and this will be obviously going on, the biggest thing is we do want to develop a citywide technology strategy. This is going to be based off of all the departmental business strategies. We want to take those individual department strategies, combine them into one citywide strategy, and then the infrastructure and applications for those things will be filled in from there. And overall, it's then the last item is how do we support this plan? You know, what do we do? One of those biggest things is we don't really have 24/7 IT support right now, but we have 24/7 operation. So that's one of our definite long-term issues is how do we identify that support on a 24/7 basis. And really with that, just to try to quickly wrap things up, we've made a lot of progress. Obviously, as you can see, there's a lot more work needed. There's going to be some initial investments that's going to be required to do some of these things. We don't know what that is yet. But again, the long-term, the goal with all this is that we are going to be saving money and being more efficient in the long term. But I think the biggest thing is the communication, especially on the technical level, between our IT staff has been really, really amazing. Everybody is committed to see this through. In the last 3 months, they've made great strides to try to make this happen. So, you know, really today the goal was just to fill you in on that. We are doing this. We are making progress. We've made a lot of progress. And I think we're going to address a number of these issues in the next few years. So really with that, that's the brief summary of where we're at.
All right. Well,
thank you for the report. I think many of us at this table, anyway, appreciate and understand the advantages of common infrastructure, leveraging skills and technology across multiple domains. It clearly pays off. And so I'll let others ask questions, but one of the key questions I've got, and maybe this is too much for you to bite off at this point, but what about integration more so with the county and their IT operations? That would seem to be another.
And I can defer some of these questions to other staff as well, but I think the bigger thing has been that we really want to try to figure out internally with us, what are we doing? How can we make sure that we're all on the same page? Because it's going to be, I think, much easier to move to integration with the county if we're integrated. If we're not integrated and we try to integrate with the county, that's basically trying to integrate four different things into one there. Where if we get ours figured out first, once we have that done, then it's one integration with one integration. Is that sort of?
Well, except as you're starting to talk about things like common infrastructure and servers and things like that, you're going to want to have some inkling of what the county is doing, because you could get a huge investment and be off totally different direction.
And I think that is happening. When we chose the laser feed system for the document management, right. I mean, one of the drivers behind that was the county already uses it.
Right.
So we are looking at those sort of things as we make these decisions moving forward.
Okay.
I think Dale's too good.
Mr.
David Dale, I feel answer that.
Oh. I mean, I will just say that in some respects, we already do integrate better with the county than we do in some of our own departments. I mean, that may be kind of strange to say, but it's true. We've been doing it for a long time because we have a joint LEC department, right? And so we've been sharing, and we've been having to figure out how to get through firewalls and all this kind of stuff for a long time. And we have BCA security requirements that organization has that we've had to deal with for a long time. But we do always, when you talk about trying to take that further, there's always the fact that we are still legally separate entities. And as such, every time we get into licensing issues, we always run up against something where they say, no, you can't do that. And Laserfish is one prime example. We actually have a joint city county planning department, if you're well aware of, but there are things that we can't do, and we're actually going to move them to our licensing structure, even though they have Laserfish in their county, just because of the data sharing and whatnot back and forth, and the Laserfish licensing and all that. Only let's take that so far. So there are some limitations from just a legal practice standpoint we can't cross.
Right. Mr. Hickey, you had a question.
Yeah, the baseline study you referenced at the beginning of your efforts here, what year was that done?
2011.
Okay. Yeah. We've got that. If you want it, I can send it to you.
All right. Thank you.
I'd like it too.
Yes, Ms. Means. You mentioned the unique needs, and currently we have quite a few departments that are developing their own processes. How do you get them to buy into a more consolidated, efficient way of operating without having, are you getting all of those departments to the point that they understand why it's essential?
Yep, and I think very much we've done that. I think over the last 3 or so months, it has come from kind of that steering committee where we're all committed, a different department are committed to making this happen. It's obviously been communicated down to the IT staff at that level, and they've been great in coming up with working through issues and ideas. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can do some of these things, and they've worked those details out and come back with their recommendations and things. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, I think we have the buy-in now. Now it's going to be an ongoing process to continue to maintain that buy-in, and we need to make sure that, as we actually start implementing some of these things, that we do it in a way that all the departments feel like their needs are being met, because you don't want it to be where somebody's feeling that they're not getting kind of what they need, so they're going to kind of go back to, well, we'll do some of this stuff on our own then, so we can cover, these sort of things. So it is going to be a very much an ongoing process, but so far to date, it has been a commitment from all departments and staff involved.
This process for no reason.
Mr. Campion.
I think it's a very noble goal to try and bring everyone together. And to that end, I guess, maybe running just slightly counter to the present statement, I would say I would prefer not to see the effort get bogged down. There's a certain point where if people aren't getting on the bus, they're not getting on the bus. And we're going to lead on this, and we're going to consolidate the technology. And if we have to get out in front of them, I think it's unfortunate if they can't come along with us, but you know, I want the group to feel empowered to make the best decisions for the city of Rochester, and I just believe that in the end, the best decision for the city of Rochester is going to be the best decision for the county. And if they want to come along, they're going to find we've already blazed a trail, and maybe they can follow us to save a little bit of money after the fact, and we can all work this out. Because they are a legally separate organization, and I totally get that, but the taxpayers fund all of them. So I think ultimately, you know, we hope to do what we can in alignment, and where it's impossible or not readily feasible, then I think we should move forward and get to the consolidation faster. Because I think the other part I've learned being in this business is the faster you get to consolidation, the faster you make the changes, the faster you realize you don't know what you're doing, and you reinvent what you end up with anyway. So, you know, I've always seen the failures start with trying to build the end result from the beginning instead of just building what you know and then incrementing it on that as you go and getting better. So I'm really happy, excited to see this take off. Glad you guys are starting to get that important buy-in with the organizations, and hope we can get started on that consolidation like the plan that you laid out.
I think that's why, though, when you see that little diagram that they had up there, and I realize there's not a lot of detail of that, but that was intentional. But the space thing we were trying to get started with was to have this shared domain, because until you have that, you can't really talk about sharing other infrastructure pieces with each other, because you can't validate your users. And so that's where we're starting. That's why we didn't just fix email first, because there's a zillion ways to do that that go around the whole other concept of starting with a base system that everybody's sharing, and then they can move what pieces, like you say, they can come on board as they get tired of trying to support all the things by themselves, and other people can join you that shared domain when they see that it works for them.
That leads conveniently into my follow-up, which is how would you like to see us measure the success of this? Because one element is the fiscal idea of we've saved money, and I think that's great. And then there's these other concepts of, you know, we've maybe saved on staff, which is a little bit more challenging to quantify. And then you get into the we can change interchange staff easier, and that's even harder to quantify. How do we see us measuring the success of this? Is it simply we get this domain done by next year, we can all thumbs up and feel good about this? Or
I think the road plan was out there so that by 16, hopefully we're actually working on the applications and all those things. I think you really measure it by saying, well, how many similar products are we trying to support at the same time? I mean, clearly at some points we're supporting 5 different HVAC systems on 6 different servers, and you know, we're supporting multiple different security systems that are different software vendors, different whatever. I mean, we start looking and saying, okay, down the road, have we eliminated at least some of those things? We have 2 different document management systems right now. We have 2 different. So, I mean, I think that's how you measure it. How many similar products do you have that are doing the same thing? Aaron mentioned the licensing thing that we put in, that maybe ultimately when we get this all together, we can use the Acela's module instead, and we don't need to have a whole separate system. So that's how you ultimately measure it. How many of those are we still kind of supporting at the same time?
That sounds great. Will we see an analysis? Is that part of the inventory that I saw up there? Will be the analysis of these are 5 tools?
In inventory, okay. Yeah. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
I think part of it, too, Dale, is it requires almost a change in thinking. The model that I'm used to is we typically delineate our efforts into 3 major categories: run, grow, and transform. You know, how much of our effort is being spent just keeping the place running, you know, maintaining, you know, and at the other end of the spectrum, what are the things that we're doing to truly transform our business to be a better unit of government in how we employ technology? So, and part of that exercise, metrics usually fall out of that. So it just, but that's
kind of the second phase of that, was getting into all the business strategies, the actual business strategies of these departments, figuring out where they're trying to go, because we're trying to come up with these technical solutions that aren't necessarily where they're going to head.
Right.
You know, I have a question, and I think it's from Councilman Member Campion's comment about how do you measure it. You know, I think that we really need to think about not only run, grow, and transform, but that old Baldwin initiative where you have your mission and visions and goals, and how do you measure it? And then what do you do if you don't meet it? How do you improve so that you can work towards, you know, better meeting it? And I honestly think that is something as a council or as a city that we all need to work on, because if you know what your goal is, then you can, you know, you have to track it and then you have to report your successes and not. So I'm hoping that at some point, Mr. Quinvold and Mr. Newman, that we will have some focus on a citywide vision on what we want to do. And obviously, you know, the highest priority would be customer satisfaction, internal and external, and continued excellence in what we do. So that's the one comment. I hope we can start thinking in that line. Then we won't have to ask what the measurements are, because everyone will be measuring it, because that's a city requirement. Secondly, as you have your IT integration efforts, are you including our businesses as well that we deal with, our developers and architects and those kind of people? And I mentioned that only because I had a meeting just recently with the Rochester Area Builders, and I think I stopped by your office to talk about that. You know, that's also, they are big customers, they're big paying customers too. And how do we improve the technology so we can help them and to be more successful and more comfortable with what we're doing in an expeditious kind of way, but absolutely quality work.
Yeah, and as part of this process, I mean, that is kind of one of the goals, obviously, is to improve customer service. I mean, if we can eliminate some, you know, the redundancy in some of the software programs we use, if we can improve the efficiency of the various IT departments with their cooperation, those sort of things, it should result in improved service to our customers, including the development community, in which I think we'll see more as we talk about building safety and Acela and some of those things, and can we tie that more with LaserFish, and how do we make sure that the county system is accessing Acela and can have the same real-time, you know, contacts and all those sort of things, because we will need that when we do look at moving closer and closer to all the online submittals and the transferring around of online documents and things for development projects. So that will definitely be a big part of it, is as that continues to move forward. And I think this whole shared domain thing will definitely help that. And once we show that this does work, and here's how the county can then, you know, participate too, because we do have to deal with the county, obviously, in many ways, especially with the development side of things. So I think this will result in that. By doing this, we will create an environment where that will be much easier to happen, to be able to have that shared between the city and the planning and those sort of things. So this should definitely help with that.
Well, it sounds like something that we'll get a report on periodically, yep. So that'll be good. In the spirit of moving things along, unless there are some other burning questions, we'll
have one quick thing. I appreciate your organization. Is there any way you could get Ben Bolt from the Park and Rec Department to add on to that steering committee? He's very up on this stuff. I think, you know, that's a big department too that deals with a lot of people. I know Paul's here, and I don't know if he'd support that or not, but just something I'd like to throw out there.
Sure.
I'll tell him you requested it.
Well, I think that we need to move from this first phase of just getting this thing up and running, and we actually move to the governance phase, and we're building that governance document, but I think we'll open it back. This was the group that basically was assigned by the department head group at the time to get going on this, and, you know, essentially what we're trying to gain from you here is this sort of assurance that you're behind this and that you want us to continue on this. I mean, that's really where the direction for all the departments to actually do this and not just keep going off on their separate directions comes from, but I think we'll definitely open back up again and start moving into the next phase.
Good, thank you. All right, thank you. All right, moving on to RPU 2014 Departmental Review. Mark.
Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure to come before the committee of the whole and talk a little bit about RPU, both in 2014 and where we're at year-to-date in 2015. In the packet, I prepared a summary of financial information and some goals and some accomplishments for both 14 and 15. Just a couple points to highlight. As you can see on the electric side in 2014, we ended the year with a positive net position and a positive variance from budget. That was in spite of the fact that our revenues were below budget. So what drove that positive net position for us was really the job staff did in managing operating expenses. We typically, at least two times a year, sometimes three, take a look at our budget to actual numbers and see if there's a trend that we are noticing. And if there is, we then go back and ask staff to say, you know, our revenues are falling behind budget. We really need to take a look at expenses and see if we can manage those to come in better than budget at the end of the year. And they did that in 2014 for the electric side. So I do want to give my kudos to the staff for managing the finances in the electric utility in 2014 to come into that position. The other thing that I'm sure you're very interested in is the ILOT transfers. Last year, the electric utility transferred $8.2 million to the city's general fund. And that really is a return on investment. As a public utility, we are owned by the citizens of Rochester, and as a payback for that ownership, we return to the city in lieu of tax payment. So that's based on a mill rate per kilowatt hour sold. So the reason why it's a little bit below budget is because our revenues and our kilowatt hours sold were a little bit below budget. So it's not tied to actual dollar revenues of the utility, it's tied to the energy that is sold and the water CCF. On the water side, a little different story. We budgeted a loss in the water utility last year, and we just about hit that dead on. That continues to be a concern for me. And we are conducting a water cost of service study as we speak. In fact, we'll be having a study session at the June 30th board meeting with our rate person to get a look at what changes may be necessary in the water department to stop the downward trend of the net position. We've been living off of our cash reserves on the water utility for a number of years now. We can see that trend over time. Those cash reserves are slowly declining. So we need to come up with a plan to reverse that trend. In addition, on the electric side, last year the council approved the three-year rate track, and part of that was the ability for the electric utility to start building some reserves for the future replacement of aging assets, so we don't get into a predicament where we've got a lot of aging assets and no money to replace them with. So we'll be looking at that same type of accounting system on the water side. We'll be starting to look at what is it going to take to put some money in the bank to eventually replace all that 100-year-old water main that's buried under the streets in Rochester. So it'll be an interesting process that we're going to go through, and obviously the council will be intimately involved in whatever comes out of that that rate study. Other than that, I guess if anybody has any questions on how we ended the year in 14, I'll take those at this point.
Any questions?
So we talk a lot about we're coming to grips with the reality of our overbuilt transportation system and infrastructure that we don't have. We have aging infrastructure with no ways to pay for it. And when we went to that utility basis in the electric, I think for comparison, what I like to point out is that just as we have a unfunded liability in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in the street network, by adopting this system at RPU, our unfunded liability in the electric system will be $0. And once we're done with the water, the unfunded liability in the water system will be $0. And that's what we should be doing with all of our assets on a citywide basis. But this is it's very good that we've taken those steps.
All right.
Just a couple of things on, I guess, the 2014 highlights. As you know, Rochester continues to grow. We added 418 new electric customers and 296 new water customers. And in 2015, we are on pace to exceed those numbers year to date. So growth has come back, not the way it was back in the 2000s and early 2000s, where we were doing 1,100 or 1,200 new services a year. But it is slowly coming back. I always like to point out the popularity of our Conserve and Save program. Our customers were able to save 21 million kilowatt hours and almost 9 million gallons of water by using our rebate programs to change out older, inefficient appliances, both on the water and electric side. So I think that's a positive metric that we can look to. Again, our capital improvement budget was rather large in 2014. A lot of that was due to our participation in the CapEx project. That's the large transmission project that's going to eventually supply Rochester with two new 161 kV sources into town to ensure a reliable transmission system to import energy into the city through 2050 potentially. So that was about a $12 or $14 million adder under our normal capital improvement budget. The other thing that is a positive is we were approved last year as a transmission-owning member in MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. That is the multi-state regional grid operator that runs the transmission system and dispatches generation in the MISO market. By being approved as a transmission owner, we are able to recover revenue for our transmission assets from others in the footprint that are using those assets. So that was a positive revenue generator that we are now seeing in 2015. So year to date for 2015, our revenues again are below budget slightly. We'll see how the summer rolls out. Typically our big energy months are June, July, and August, obviously, with the summer temperatures. So again, we're watching these numbers closely. Our operating expenses are below budget. And so we have a positive net position above budget so far in 2015, but it is early. We're just hitting our peak construction season, and so we'll see how the projects and the expenses are rolling in. And we'll be getting our 2016 budget preparation here in another month or so, and as part of that we go back and we do what's called an F2, a reforecast of our 2015 budget. We ask all of the staff to go back and make sure and tell us exactly what they think they're going to get done this year and what may not get done and either get pushed off to next year or not get done at all. So we continue to monitor the budgets as we go along, and hopefully we can come in better than the $1.5 million loss that we had budgeted in 2015. A couple of the major goals for this year, one item to note is as of June 1st, Silver Lake plant is completely transitioned out of the electric generation business and the coal. We've not burned coal there for about a year and a half now, but we are out of the electric generation business at the Silver Lake plant. It continues to operate on natural gas, supplying high pressure steam to Mayo under a contract that runs through 2025. So that's been a very valuable partnership that we have with Mayo, and we look forward to potential new partnerships that we could develop with Mayo as DMC and other initiatives go on downtown. We are getting ready to ask the board to approve a purchase power agreement for a 500 kW solar array. That array will be placed at the service center, out in front of the service center. So that's an exciting project for us. That's our toe in the water, so to speak, in the solar farm concept. Much bigger than obviously rooftops and some of those kind of things that go on in the city today. But we've got over 600 kW of individually owned solar systems in the city that RPU has rebated for as part of their Conserve Save program. But this will be a standalone 500 kW solar array. The other big ticket item that I want to point out is we're getting ready to update our strategic plan. In fact, we just completed an intensive customer survey, phone survey, and we have two focus group meetings coming up this week. Great Blue, an independent research firm, hired to conduct those phone surveys and do those focus groups. The information we glean from that will be the basis that the board and staff will use to update the strategic plan. One of the pillars of public power is that we're community-owned and we respond to the wishes and the desires of the community. Well, you can't do that unless you know what the community wants. So this is an effort to get an insight into what does the community of Rochester want from RPU, and then we can adjust our strategic plans, our budgets, and our goals based on the input we receive from those surveys. So we're really excited about the results of that, and that will give us some good information to go forward. And we're completing the substation work for the second CapEx line, which will be energized this fall. That will secure both sources into the city for a new transmission system. And then I did attach, just for your review, our 2014 through 2016 strategic plan. I won't go into any details unless you have questions. I'd be happy to answer them. We really focused on what we call the five R's: rates, reliability, relationships, reputation, and responsibility. And there's a definition under each one of those that we work with to set up our budgets, to set up our annual plans, and to engage with our customers in delivering that water and electric service. So with that, I'll entertain any questions.
All right. Any questions?
I love your brochure.
Oh, thank you.
And especially the mission, vision, and core values.
Yes, we've been working on that with staff for a number of years now, and it's really ingrained into all of the staff at RPU at this point. We've had it around for quite a while now. We talk about it and focus on it quite often.
I just had a question on the third bullet under your goals and plans: installation of a 500 kilowatt solar array. Now, you're using some solar now or not?
No, RPU doesn't own any solar outright. All of the solar that's on our system is owned by individuals or businesses. We do have a rebate program where we have helped those folks fund those projects, but they're privately owned. So this is the first, if you want to call it, publicly owned community solar we've done.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mr. Rusk.
I just want to ask, you touched on it a little bit, but the Silver Lake plant, you're going to work on it. Looks like it's going to be operational until 2025 at least by this contract that you have. But it's a big area, a lot of buildings. I drive by there, I look at it, and I'm like wondering, are we using a lot of that or most of it? Or is there some type of a plan on what you're going to do with that into the future, or is it just status quo for now? I know, you know, like Park and Rec's looking for storage for vehicles and stuff. Seems like they have a lot of building there, so.
Yes, right now it's probably a little early to tell you what we're going to do with that site exactly. It's still an operating plant per se, but as we transition out of kind of the storage of equipment and things that those buildings are full of now, we'll have that opportunity to take a look at that space and see, do we need it for something in the future? Could we make it available to other city departments? I know Paul and Wally have worked on some potential storage in kind of an empty gravel lot kind of behind the plant. So we'll have those discussions as time goes on as to what we want to repurpose that site for.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Campion.
Yeah, so one of the kind of these reputation responsibility items that you said, you know, you reach out with the community and trying to hear what they value. I got a couple emails today about burying power lines downtown. Wondering, I know at one point we had a discussion where you guys were kind of going back to formulate a policy or to come back with some policy words about it. I kind of wondering where that's at.
We are still working on that. My plan is to incorporate that kind of into our budget discussions, because depending on what we do there or what policy we come up with, will have an impact on our budgets. So we really need to kind of do it in conjunction with that process. But yeah, it's still on the list of to-dos. And we are still investigating what others do in that arena and what potentially we may be able to do to come up with. Obviously, the issue isn't necessarily doing it or not doing it. The issue is, how do you fund it?
Right.
It costs money to do those things. So.
Just so I make sure I put all the pieces together, you're also in the middle of a rate study. Is that what I heard earlier?
Not on the electric side.
Water side.
On the water side.
We finished the rate study for electric, so no change there, but the
right.
Water is being, okay. Just want to make sure. Thanks.
Yep.
All right. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
All right, we have next up the Art Center 2014 review.
Hi there, I'm Larry Guzzi. I'm the current president of the board of the Rochester Art Center. I'm also a senior vice president of Think Mutual Bank, which is a significant supporter of the Art Center as well. And I just wanted, before Shannon's presentation, share with you, it seems to be the theme of the day, mission, vision, and one of the things that as our board of directors, we're charged with is making sure that the organization meets their mission. And I could read it to you, I could tell you I think we are, but I think it's pretty well summed up from a letter to the editor recently, and it was from Daniel Holland, who was the son of our founder, Newt Holland, and just a few phrases that he used. I was astonished by the incredible metamorphosis of that organization. It has been amazing for me to watch the dream of my father, Newt Holland, transformed into stunning reality. It might have been sufficient for the Rochester Arts Center to rest upon its past laurels, but instead, it now provides one of the most significant examples of the limitless possibilities of creativity anywhere in the country. And also that we're meeting his father's vision of making Rochester a cultural center worthy of its scientific achievement. And I truly think that's what the Art Center has done. Hopefully you're seeing that. And I think Shannon can present what that looks like. So, and if there's any questions of me, I'll stick around and take those. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, the invitation of Mr. Kimball. So thank you very much. We usually do this annually in August, September, but I was invited to present in June to really talk about our accomplishments and goals and what we achieved in 2014 and share how we did that. This presentation is not connected yet.
There we go.
I've organized this always around our strategic plan that was adopted in 2010 and goes through 2015. So we mark our success and our achievements and revisitation through this, and there's four major goals. And the first and foremost is to continue to deliver exceptional contemporary art exhibitions to our community. And annually, we do this with 3 to 4 major exhibitions of artists from around the globe and in our backyard. This past January, we did a career survey of an exhibition with David Rathman, who's lived and worked in Minnesota for over 20 years. We presented 25 years of his creative production and documented it in a book and received national funding for this from the Andy Warhol Foundation in New York, and for our scholarship funding from Elizabeth Firestone Grant. These are big markers that the nation is paying attention to what we're doing. It is an enormous opportunity and reward and pleasure to support an artist. The exhibition was packed, super well received. This is very meaningful for an artist of David's stature in his mid-50s to have all this work gathered together, often for the first time in years. They're owned by private collections. There's an example of our publication. This contributes to the scholarship and the contextualization for the artist. We hire writers to, above and beyond our own voice to talk about our artists. Next up, last winter, you may have remembered this very beautiful and complex exhibition by Japanese artist Chihara Shioto. This is an exhibition, for example, when we create something new in-house, internally on-site, so site-responsive. This is over 1 million feet of black yarn, and literally our place was emptied out and transformed into a web, this beautiful web. Chihara Shioto is interested, she's from Osaka, Japan, but she's interested in memory and reconciliation and calm. The space was contemplative, but it was also dark and haunting, as contemporary art and life is. The children loved it. It was kind of a maze of woven cathedral. This project was only possible because we invited the community of Rochester to help. We had over 75 volunteers participate in the production of this work. That is an aspect of ownership in creating our spaces and our exhibitions. People in our community enjoy getting to know the artistic practice. And again, continuing our interest in publications, we produced this stunning, beautiful catalog that invited a premier Japanese poet to contribute poetry to support the art exhibition. These are distributed nationally, and our good name is out in the world. You may remember this summer, we had the opportunity to work with Lamar Peterson, an African-American artist from New York City, who just relocated to the Twin Cities, so we're very fortuitous. Similar prestigious funding from across the country, but also our local foundation, the Werner Schmidt Foundation, has come back after 5 years to provide support for this exhibition. This is also a survey exhibition, but not 25 years, 15 years, where we were able to follow the trajectory of an artist's career and see how that changes. We were also able to fill that sculpture pad with a gigantic inflatable Eastern seabird that was very important for the artist. The artist was very involved with workshops, community workshops. He did about 3 with our communities pictured here. This is the first African-American artist we've focused on in about 8 years in our major exhibition program. That is part of our strategic plan to diversify both our staff, programs, and board. I'm not sure what happened to the catalog, but again, that slide is pink. We produced a catalog again from Lamar Peterson, and we were so excited to learn that our local business, Davies Printing Company, who we work and support, was awarded a national prize for the design of that catalog. Next up, this is our last exhibition of 2014. It really resonated. It was large. It was beautiful. It was during the metamorphosis of seasons. It was during our fall. We had five very large Minnesota trees turned up in and rotated and move out through our space. This is an exhibition that you could smell, you could breathe, you could feel it. These are giant upended paintbrushes. Really beautiful about time, memory, lost in nature. How we mark that through the change of seasons. It also included a drum set that many of you may remember because you helped us secure two Rochester retired police cars to make this sound drum set that he made on site. This is Michael Seelstorfer, who joined us from Berlin. I just want to continue how we support our Minnesota artists. We're in our 10th year of the Third Floor Emerging Artist Series, fully funded by Jerome Foundation for the great work we do. We just currently have our 41st solo exhibition. This is often a young artist's first exhibition in their career, and it's often the first time they're written about. And very locally, our RIC Square exhibition series continues. This is only about Rochester and our area, but we celebrate creativity. We have presented 28 artists in 4 years, and this has had consistent funding from Rochester Downtown Alliance and two individual foundations since its inception, and we're really proud of that. They've become very popular, very well attended. This is a new partnership we launched with, again, Rochester area artists to curate the shows in our People's Food Co-op. This is how we connect good contemporary art to good health and good food. It's a great partnership. Number two, that we are welcoming and integrated to all our visitors. We have more tours in our history than last year. Children to adults, St. John's adores us. They come for every show. Our English as Second Language is a really strong program. Right now, we are partnering with all of these schools. Our education initiatives have tripled in 2013, and I'm proud to tell you, in 2014, they quadrupled since 2012. That is quadrupling the number of people we are serving through our programs. And the end of 2014, it was over 13,000. 3 years ago, it was 3,000 annually. We have one of the hottest teen programs about creativity and making art. What they get to do, Day of the Dead, work with our public schools. When this public school didn't have an art program, we stepped in for 3 years and we provided their art courses. We expand our public art education with the Hiawatha Valley League exhibition show. We're now in our third year, highlighting 11 schools and organizations. Partnering with Rochester Community Technical College and their fine art students. Considering the knowledge and expertise in our own community with poets and philosophers with our new Know Now program. Also inviting artists from around the world who are pioneers in their field. This isn't about emerging artists, but the pioneers of the ground. Juneteenth, some of our social programs. In 2014, we partnered for the first time with NAACP of Rochester, the first time with Juneteenth. Continuing a beautiful, strong relationship with Diversity Council, and we had over 450 people at Rochester Art Center celebrating this commemoration. We just did this past Sunday at Cook Park. I don't know if any of you attended. Choral Arts Ensembles continue to be a wonderful partnership. 4 years ago, we had partnerships with just under 10 community groups in this community. Right now, we have 39. Very excited for this year. We are third participation in a great relationship with Rochester Civic Theater. We'll participate in Pride Fest again with a curated film program. We have been recognized for our interest in diversity, and last year I was very thrilled and honored to be presented a champion of diversity and joined a very esteemed group of colleagues. Think Free Thursdays helps us reach more and more people. It's our only day we're open late and free. We introduce new ideas, and this is something we're really proud of, how contemporary art relates to other ideas. It can relate to health, and Dr. Ahmet Sub talking about memory resiliency. It can relate to fun stories about gnomes in your yard with luminary artist Judy Onofrio. It can be dancing with Winston Howard to get your salsa arm inside our galleries. And it can also be fresh food, fresh off our local farms with the People's Food Co-op. And tea. How can you connect tea to the history of art and art history? Lastly, again, our value to the residents of Rochester, how we listen to the residents and produce for them. Our openings are drawing hundreds of people. We continue to participate in the Blue Star Museums, not just between Memorial Day and Labor Day. We are open and free to all former military, current military, year-round. We partner and support and are proud of our partners who also believe in the value of art throughout our community. C4, Creator Salon, Santes, RDA. I think most of you saw the Red Ball. Great partnership. Our free family day serves 3,000 people annually for free. We continue to have, again, really strong partners with the library. We love working with our neighbors, the theater, Oxbow. Post Bulletin, design an ad. Look at those youngsters designing ads. Total Arts Day Camp began last week. It began its 44th year. Again, this was founded by Judy Onofrio with the idea and vision that we provide art for young people. Our place is a hub of activity. This is taught by professors that we serve throughout the year, usually right out of their MFA program, so we're providing an income source for professors and assistants. Last year, the Artie, Mayor Brady is not here, but we were nominated for 3 awards. We were very excited for that, for a volunteer, for collaboration, and then we were awarded it with our progress in art education. That is an award that keeps us on its toes and making to constantly improve what we do in art education. Lastly, and I'll be wrapping this up, to do all this, takes a very responsible funding plan and what we've been able to do. Increase attendance. Increase attendance is connected to the value of what we're doing and our strength of our programs. And we've been increasing them from 10% to 20%. And our highest attendance, as I mentioned, was just this past year. In 2012, we had our first most successful annual fund in our 10-year history. We exceeded it in 2013 and again in 2014. And this whole crew and team is working for the value of our rentals is so important, especially now. And since 2012, annually, we contribute to the city of Rochester more than $1 million in hospitality market. That is more than our annual budget. We're very proud of how much business designers, hotels, creatives, caterers get from us. It's our stunning space. You know how beautiful it is, how it can be transformed. Right now, it's utilized 43 weekends with 2 events each of those weekends a year. So we're only 9 weekends off from being fully rented and functioning and at capacity. For 5 years in a row, we are a top 10 venue throughout the entire state for our weddings. And last year, we looked at our catering model. There is a graphic missing, which is Santes. Previously, we had 11 cafe vendors, catering vendors, and we, as a business model, took into consideration the caterers in our town who have the best and service and product and create an alliance with 3. I think it was a very smart business decision. All 3 of these caterers, and again, it includes Santes, Powers Ventures, Catering by Design, really believe in our mission and contribute back. It's been an excellent partnership, and we're so proud of it. Last year, our highest goal in earned income was ever achieved. Our goal was $180,000, and we earned, through our rentals, just our rentals, $192,000. It couldn't be more important. This has just gone past what the city contributes and what our grants contribute. So it's absolutely vital to our success. And I include a quote because of construction from a patron who rented our place in April. You know I was concerned about the construction for our event, but I want to tell you how our day went flawlessly. And all the feedback from accessibility to the food, to the staff, to the space was only positive. So I want to share that. When you get to our building, it's still lovely. These are some measurements we put in place about good stewardship and fiscal responsibility. We have a new resource and advancement committee comprised of business leaders throughout our committee helping us identify the best way we can share our value to businesses, of course, sustainability. Our annual art bash last year was our highest ever. We had amazing co-chairs, but it was celebrating 10 years of our program, 10 years in our beautiful space, 10 years of education. And you can see the progress the last 3 years with art bash. It's not only a party, but all of that income goes directly to our programs. 90% goes back to art education initiatives. 2012, we raised $16,000. 2013, 43, and last year our highest ever at $55,000. That represents the generosity of our community wanting us to achieve our goals. These are things you're very aware that we've accomplished that help us achieve our goals. These are the tools to enable us to run our nonprofit. Reboot was accomplished, Reconnect was accomplished. We have a new website and database last year that has really provided all of our staff the ability to do what we do and continue. Our goals for this year, 2015, as we're 6 months in, to sustain all the commitment we have achieved, our visibility and access, to include increased support. This is my last slide because I think it's a piece of the pie that will be of very much interest. This is where we are, 2014. The most important thing, in my estimation, is how much we spend on education, exhibitions, and programming. 3 years ago, this is at 56%. So last year's at 62, over here is at 62. Another graphic for the first time. Our earned income and the city is greater than the city contribution. Our individual giving and grants is much greater than the earned giving and that. That's being internally generated and for 3 years surpassed what the city is committing. And I say that just because we are raising the bar what we're bringing in to match that. We are working on a campaign for these graphics and to be able to share that with business leaders as we go forward, increasing our tracking. So as always, I thank how much the City of Rochester contributes to our success, and thank you for your time, and look forward to another year.
All right, Mr. Wood.
Thanks, Shannon. We're very fortunate to have you. You've done some really incredible things. I know that we've had a number of new staff people come in. I know some of them are, so you have some staff folks here. Would you like to introduce them?
Yeah, we have the enormous opportunity to increase our professionalism. We have a new curator. Her job is curator of art and public engagement. Susanna Majors joins us. She has joined us from San Francisco. And her goal is to talk about art and curating and how it impacts our community through engagement, literally. I'm very excited. Devin Nichols joined us last year, and her job is both curatorial and development, creating artistic endeavors that relate to fundraising and membership. We also have a new curator of education who's not here today, Jonah Speller, but she has joined us 3 months ago and has really increased that access, visibility. That professionalization is absolutely about how we've gotten here. You know, we were anemic for a while with the staff building.
Awesome. All right. And then the other thing I was going to point out too is, I mean, you can see how everything's headed in the right direction. Now we got a little bit of a challenge in front of us, of course, with the space. And you know what? Right now I think we're just trying to document and understand how the space is affecting the rentals. And you know, if we need to go back and address that, I'm hoping that we're willing to do that. It's going to be phenomenal for the facility when it's done, but it's sometimes tough to get there. Sometimes people don't always follow the signs quite right, huh?
All right. Mr. Goldberg.
Not her. It's
Shannon, I just want to say thank you. I know I've probably been one of the hardest people in the Arts Center, but you've really come through. Looking at what you're doing and your percentage and the growth of financing that you're getting from outside, what you're doing at the Arts Center and how often it's busy during weekends. It's not just during the weekends. You're also very busy during the week and the evening. There's a lot of activities that go on. I think you guys have done a tremendous job, and I just want to say thank you.
We have a great board and great staff. So.
All right, Mr. Campion.
I think I'd just add that you know, we all understand the unique circumstance that some of the periphery organizations, actually all the organizations in the Civic Center are under right now. And you know, as leaders, I think we'd like to hear sooner rather than later if things start to get shaky in any way. I know we all kind of probably had a little bit of pause when we saw that there was at least one email that came through concerned about the rental, and I'm really happy to see, you know, it looks like your staff is probably pulling those extra hours and going to the extra mile to make sure we're delivering a fantastic experience for people when they rent that space. But you know, we'd like to hear sooner rather than later, and I think you're going to find a really receptive audience here to understanding the unique circumstances you guys are all under because of that construction. I think we're here to work with you, and we want to make sure that you know, none of your organizations have to fear being open and honest about the, you know, what's happening over there. So You know, obviously today's presentation speaks for itself. I think we're all in awe of what's been accomplished over there. It's a real tremendous asset for the community, and really look forward to see what you do when you keep putting, if there's another gear, I'm excited to watch you get into it.
Yeah, I think the rentals, you know, you saw the figures there for 2014. We are watching that very closely as we go through 2015. We've had some bumps along the way, but to your point, the staff has done a really good job of trying to get past that and you know, help people along through that, realizing there's some other ways to get there, and city departments have been great about assisting us with that, different entry points, some of those things. So we'll keep watching it and certainly take a look at projections and see where we're going.
All right, Ms. Means.
Everyone said all those great things, and I mirrored those comments as well. It's just incredible what you've achieved to uplift our art center, not only from this national but internationally, and I just commend you for the work that you've done. You have to tell us, though, how the Zumba's going and the lunches.
I didn't know.
Is it Zumba? Are you doing Zumba?
We have not yet.
Gotcha.
But we do work. We did salsa with Winston Howard, and he is coming on board dancing a lot more, so Zumba could be next.
It's another way to get people to come into the Art Center. So very creative that you thought about having those two venues inside the Art Center. So it's not Zumba, it's salsa?
It was salsa last Thursday evening, and we're going to mix it up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sandra, the workload is Zumba.
Oh, okay. Sandy, whatever that means. The workload is Zumba?
We're dancing.
All right, good.
All right. Anyone else? Well, thank you very much for your
thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to hazard mitigation outreach report, Mr. Jones.
This is your daily drive.
I'd like to, before I begin, I'd like to introduce Tony Schmitz. Tony is contracted by the Emergency Community Health Outreach nonprofit that worked with us on developing this report that you see in front of you, Safe for Everyone. Tony was the author, and I've asked him to come and speak today. Before he does, I would just like to say a couple of words. You've heard me talk in the past about what we try to do within emergency management. Right in the middle, it talks about building an effective emergency, having an effective emergency response, building a disaster resilient community, building community partnerships, and keeping everyone informed. It's our vision, it's our goals, it's what we drive toward with emergency management. In 2013, we applied for and received a grant to develop an all-hazard mitigation plan. As one of the first things within that, we wanted to develop more, a better outreach. We knew that we had a lot of people that were involved in different aspects of the city, but when we sat down with Jeff and Planning and Sandy and said, what can we do that's a little bit better? One of the things that we realized is that we really don't have good inroads to our communities with disabilities or with the limited English proficiency community, the immigrant communities. So as part of building that network, we wanted to engage a couple of consultants to help us with doing very good outreach. And the charge that we gave them is that we want it to be meaningful and we want it to be sustainable. We don't want to just do this or produce a report. We want something that's going to be more long-lasting. When we started off, one of the things that I discovered was this sign on Broadway near 6th Street And I thought that I showed it, took a picture of it. I showed it in the presentation when we did the Inclusion Solutions Report, Connect 2080. That was for the disabilities community. And I just wanted to look at it again now because I think it really kind of speaks to the sort of things that as I'm out there in emergency management, what are we doing? I'm looking for guidance, and this is one of those things that I look at that says, okay, somebody put this up, it's important for us, how can we do a better job in this one area? Regarding that, FEMA also has its own drivers, its own goals that they want us to accomplish. And the FEMA director, in testifying before Congress, stated that FEMA has two guiding principles. One, a whole community approach, and two, that they want to foster innovation and learning. I think that we accomplished that with this particular project, especially in regards to the whole community approach. And then, before I turn it over to Tony, I was at a workshop recently, and there was this long poem or excerpt from Peter Block, who's kind of a community outreach person. He's written a couple of books. And in this poem, he has the way we create conversations. I think he really captures much better than I can even write myself the idea that I don't necessarily mean to say that we have a fragmented nature, but in many ways we do operate within our own worlds. And how can we go beyond that? It really does come to the conversations that we have with one another. And now I'd like to turn it over to Tony.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to start just by explaining the two big jobs we understood we had ahead of us. You know, one was to get ahead of these communities. We're working with three communities, the Cambodian, Latino, and Somali communities. Our idea was to start there because they form the largest portion of your population here in Rochester. Our idea initially was, well, we want to ask you about what kind of emergencies concern you most. You know, is it a flood, is it a mass disease, is it attacks, tornadoes, trains blowing up on the railroad tracks out here? What is it? How do you hear about those things? Do you hear about those things? You hear a siren blow, do you know what that means? That was our starting point. But the other thing that both Ken and Sandy made very clear to us is that's about half of the job. The other half is to try to start to build some kind of relationship within these communities so that people know who you are, know that you have some interest in understanding what their situation is, that you're not just doing this as a one-shot deal, but you want to have a relationship that you can go back to over time so that you're not starting from scratch with the next thing that is a concern within these communities, you know, within your relationship between you and these communities. So that's the position we started from. You know, there are two ways to do this kind of work. There's the easy way, and that would be to, you know, send out a note to everybody, send out the press release, invite them to a big meeting, buy a bag of donuts and a box of coffee, schedule the room, and watch as nobody shows up, because that, within the experience that Efren, my colleague at Echo, and I have had over time, people don't come because they don't know you, they don't really think you're serious. They don't think that what they have to say is really going to be paid attention to. There's another way to do it that actually works, in our experience, which is you pick up the phone. This is, of course, something that would recognize as the phone anymore. But nonetheless, you call, and you start by thinking, I'm going to make one call, and this is going to be like putting, you know, honey out for the bees, man. You know, it's just going to work. People are going to show up. The other lesson is, no, that doesn't really work either. What you really have to do is call again, be unfailingly polite, but persistent in a way that you can never imagine you're going to need to be. And there's, you know, a reason for that. You know, it's not that people are rude or they don't care or they're just completely uninterested in these subjects, but the thing is, you're dealing with people who are incredibly busy, respected in their own community, and have a million alligators chewing at their ankles. This guy up here, Mikhail Valdez Soto, you know, he is involved, if it involves anything with the Hispanic community, he is involved in it. You know, he's active in a group called CARE, the Community Alliance for Racial Equity, that is kind of a major thing here in Rochester among communities of color. He's, you know, active in his church. He's active in ACLA, the, you know, Chicano Latino organization. He runs, he works for Mayo Clinic. He runs a pedicab company. He also runs a youth group, Pata de Perro, that is helps kids get bikes and, you know, repair them. And so, you know, when I call him and say, geez, Mikhail, you know, why don't you just carve out 5 minutes here? You know, why don't we sit down for a half an hour? He's kind of thinking, oh, man, this is one more thing. Miriam Goodson, same deal, you know, active in all the Latino organizations, active in her church. People, you know, when they have problems, they call these people, you know, just like you. I mean, they are leaders in their community. People get messed up. These are the guys they call. Mohammed Hamoud works at Mayo on the mosque board of the mosque. Also, you know, it's possible not to recognize the tremendous esteem with which these people are held in their own communities. Short-lived is listed to be Prime Minister of Somalia, but he's, you know, walking around working at Mayo now. Boonli Sui, Cambodian, you know, arrived here in 1979, one of the first Cambodians here in Rochester, is, again, works as an interpreter, but again, is a guy who, you know, if you have a problem, you're messed up, you don't understand something, you call him, you know, and you try to understand, and he understands that he has to help you, you know, he has to help you, he has an obligation when it's in his community to help you. So, you know, Efren and I are calling these guys, and they're thinking, well, this is one more deal, you know, where somebody wants to do a survey. Somebody wants me for a one-shot deal where they're crossing the T and dotting the I on the government report that needs to be done. And they're actually not really that serious about, you know, actually getting my opinion. They just want this. They want to, you know, make the check and get this thing out the door. So we spent a tremendous amount of time calling, you know, arranging meetings then to say, we would be honored. We, you know, it would be a privilege if you would come to this larger meeting of people from all three of these groups so that we can talk together about how we should proceed, you know, to find out what you know, what your communities know, how you hear about emergency information, and what we can do to make it better. So, you know, that's where we were. We had meetings one-on-one with people to convince them we are serious, we are really serious. We had the large community meeting. Sandy and Ken led all those meetings, all the focus group meetings, as, you know, in part a demonstration of seriousness of intent, that they hadn't just fobbed this job off on a couple of consultants, but were engaged in it seriously as a real thing involving, you know, the real power structure of the city. And what we heard, you know, we expected, okay, we're going to talk, and people say, it's, you know, floods, man. Floods are really what's on my mind. The fire, that train down there, or whatever. Proving the capacity of people always to mess you up a little bit. You know, what people said is, no, it's really not any of that stuff. It's this 911 system. You know, we call 911. I speak Cambodian. I don't really speak English. I say in Cambodian, there's a fire, or my husband's, you know, flopping on the floor. They say, what? and where do we go from there? You know, it's if you've ever been in Mexico and say, you know, a donde es el baño, you're wondering, well, where's the bathroom? And you're hoping the guy's going to say, hey, look, it's just down there. You know, you're hoping they don't give you a complicated, well, it's down there. This is going to do that because you're lost. And that's what, you know, people in the Cambodian community, Somali community, the Latino community were telling us. Look, you know, flood, fire, famine, it's not the biggest deal. You know, it's just your screwball 911 system. I can't understand what anybody's saying to me. So, you know, what happens, you ask a question. You know, you think you're asking a question, you're looking for an answer over here. We asked a question, and they're saying, no, forget about your question. This is our problem right here. And now you have this system set up where you're saying, we want to take your concerns seriously. We want to hear what you're saying. We're not just dotting I's. You've got this question now. What are you doing with your 911 system? And a measure of your seriousness of intent is going to be, well, what are you doing about your 911 system? How are you going to make that work, people? You know, it's a puzzler. And not one subject to, you know, an easy answer, unfortunately. A lot of what people had to say, though, you know, does offer an opportunity for solutions, I think. You know, part of what, say, like the Somalis and the Latinos, Cambodians to an extent had to say was, you know, we get here and we're from an equatorial region. And let's face it, you know, there aren't snowstorms. You can't die if you walk out, you know, your door. There aren't tornadoes to speak of. We don't even understand this stuff. You know, and it would be very helpful if somebody would just come out and tell us, you know, how to deal with these kinds of issues. You know, the complexity of it is you can't write a brochure. You know, people aren't going to, they don't read English. They don't read, in many instances, their own language. So you're going to have to come up with, you know, audiovisual ways to do this. Another suggestion, something Efren can describe in a little bit more detail, is this idea of basically community health workers for emergency management, people who are ambassadors within these communities who go out to other people within their community to speak the same language. They understand their concerns. They can help educate people to the, you know, complexity of the environment here, to the, you know, hazards that, you know, can occasionally come in front of them. We have, you know, other suggestions that came up along the way were to integrate emergency information into the TV stations, the radio stations, so they're pre-recorded in languages that can be understood by people, to negotiate with the stations to present this kind of information. There are a number of solutions like that that are very, you know, that you can find on page 19 of this report that I won't burden you with at the moment. But, you know, the more complex thing, I think, is how you establish these relationships so that the programs you want to implement are believed as being serious, so that you have a relationship that actually does go on over time, that you can use time and again in, you know, different ways for different subjects. You know, the people we talked to said there are instances where this is being done within Rochester. Michael, they mentioned your coffee session. You know, it's a, and you know, they said that in a respectful way. You know, in a way where they're saying, "This is really an instance of trying to reach out, trying to understand what is up with us, and we respect that." Similarly, Tina Liebling, Kim Norton, your state reps are respected for their efforts to, you know, get out, talk to people, you know, and honestly try to hear their concerns. You know, and it suggests something. You know, people again and again mentioned to us, one thing that would be tremendously encouraging to us is if you simply came, you know, to our churches, came to our temples, came to our festivals and our mosque and our dinners, and don't come in a suit, don't come with an agenda. but simply come, you know, to be with us and to understand a little bit more about what our situation is, who we are, and, you know, how we work with each other. You know, within the, you know, this, I hate to say it quite this way because it sounds Maoist, but within, you know, the white power structure, basically, these things are happening casually all the time. You know, I go to the Y, and I stand around naked in the shower with a guy who happens to be the head of the state economic development department. Another guy who runs the five-state lobbying effort for Planned Parenthood, heads of major foundations in the city, guys who, you know, are aides to the city council. You know, they're just there, and we talk about our kids the way you're talking about here. You know, flooding damage with, you know, the guy back there. It's just casual conversation that exists, you know, that creates a human contact that is about 50% of the, you know, work with government in its own oddball way, I think, often. And those are the things that we, you know, have talked about more seriously since, are ways to, you know, build those relationships over time so that you're dealing with this problem of emergency management, but more, you know, profoundly you're dealing with the issue of how you move, you know, from the way that communities of color are often perceived. You know, it's us, and then the communities of color are them. And what you want to get to is a position where you're talking about, you know, us and we. And that is a, you know, complex piece of work that is accomplished on a kind of basis. But it's fundamentally, you know, the two things that we were working on together. So, you know, it was a really splendid experience working with both Cam and with Sandy, and to go out and yap with people here in Rochester within these communities of color. I'm grateful, and I hope that ultimately this is of some help to you in an ongoing way.
We started this in 2014, and really kind of completed it last October. We produced the report finally in December, and have just been looking for an opportunity to come and finalize it as part of the All Hazard Mitigation Plan. It's one of the things that we need to do is we just wanted to come periodically and do a little bit of catch up on where we're at a certain time. I wanted to ask, I should invite Efren Malinrado. Efren works for ECHO, and I'd like him to explain a little bit about what ECHO does and its mission. And Efren.
Thank you for this opportunity. And it's interesting for me to be here because I also come from a different perspective to this issue. I remember when I moved to Minnesota about 20 years ago, actually more than that, I finished my college degree. I couldn't understand why people could be outside when it was 70 degrees. To me, that was cold weather. I'm from Puerto Rico, I was freezing, and I said, these people are literally crazy. And I was inside of a building, looking at everybody having fun, and I couldn't really comprehend, oh my gosh, what is this? And a lot of our communities don't understand what's happening and what are the risk of the hazards of the emergency that they could face, you know, in coming to this place, coming to this country, especially this area. But in the last 3 years, a lot of things have changed. Also, I remember back then, I probably was the only Latino, maybe two Latinos back in college. And it was very rare to see somebody like me around. But now, the population has changed a lot. And immigrant communities have grown a lot, and we notice that also here in Rochester because it's been happening almost everywhere throughout the state. And with that also, new challenges have emerged, and especially in the area of emergency management. And we have to find a way to collaborate and find a way to solve those issues. And that's where ECHO jumps in. If you can see the our mission is to collaborate with diverse communities to deliver programs and services that help people to be healthy, contribute, and succeed. And we focus our job on all these five different topics. You know, we talk about health, safety, emergency preparedness, community engagement, training, and outreach. And ANCO focused on those issues because we have realized that there is a gap. There is a gap in communication, there is a gap in knowledge, there is a gap in different in tools, and how to access those tools and resources, and how to use them and take advantage of those resources. So 11 years ago, ANCO started using mainly TV in partnership with the TPT, and develop some programs in some of those topics, and we've brought in experts, and we recorded half an hour program. It was translated into or captioned into different languages, and then we started presenting the programs every night. We're still presenting those programs on Monday nights at 9 p.m. on TPT, so if you want to catch some of them, you're welcome to do so. A lot of them are also in our website. You can download or you can watch them there if you want to. But after, you know, ANCO continue to grow, and we have developed a whole range of ways to provide that information to our communities. And you can see we use everything from print media all the way to DVDs and everything in between, website, social media, Facebook, everything. We are using different ways to reach our communities and make that connection and make our communities aware of all those different situations. Right now, we also have a partnership with about 200 different organizations, and they use our products and our services too in different ways. A very important part of our program also has to do with or provide opportunities for the people in our communities to also show their expertise, right? We mainly focus on prevention because we want to educate and we want to prepare our communities to be ready and know what to do in case of an emergency or when they have, and when they're facing different situations, difficult situations. But we also want our communities to continue growing and to be able to navigate the different systems, not only the emergency preparedness system, but also the educational system, the health system, and those other systems that are very the educational systems are very complicated, and learn to use the resources that are available to them. And we have a group of about 65, and we call them ambassadors, are our people from all different cultural groups, and they're trained, and they also become part of those, you know, important part of those communities, and we help us to spread the word to them. Also, I think that ANCO provides a safe space where members of the mainstream community and also members from our communities can connect, and that's what we were talking about. That's a space where we can both come together, we can develop healthy relationships, we can share expertise, and we can learn from each other, because that's what acculturation is all about. When it's only one way, it's assimilation. When it's both ways, then that's really the acculturation process. That's what we really will be thinking about. And finally, I believe that ANCO gives the immigrant community a voice, not only about cultural competency, because I think that's one of the biggest issues, that they come to us because people think that we are only expert in cultural competency. But I think ANCO provides a voice to our communities in other issues where there is a whole bunch of people and members who are also experts in other areas, and that we can also come together, collaborate, and learn from each other. And that's why ANCO, we saw a great opportunity with this project, and we are willing to continue collaborating with you. Thank you.
Okay, that's it.
Mr. Wojcik.
Do we have studies for the number of or the penetration of smartphones in the immigrant community?
No, we don't.
I believe was either Knight Foundation or Pew Foundation study recently about penetration of cell phone technology into various communities. In fact, in Latino, and I believe also, I'm kind of, remembering this, but,
sure.
Both growth and concentration in those two Latino and Black communities is, going to have to make up a number higher, much higher than you would expect, and that's people's primary connection to the internet. But, is there and usable, and presents an opportunity.
Well, and I think that's one of the things I was getting at is that, that access to technology is kind of a great equalizer. And, I don't know if there's apps that are available that, customize, short messages for emergency response via smartphone technology. Because I don't know what the penetration rate is, but I'm sure it's much higher than landline phones.
Yeah, no, it's much, much better than you expected.
I expect it's pretty high still, so.
Yeah, I mean, there are complexities involved in it still because, you're dealing with people who don't necessarily speak English at all and who also, in many instances, aren't literate. So the idea of a cell phone is, it's all a little bit more complicated than you think it's going to be.
I mean, it's hard because if nothing else, you want to figure out how, even if there's no communication, they can get a pinpoint where the signal's coming from or something just so if there's something truly bad that we can get a response, but...
I think another thing we found is that, the kind of personal, verbal, word of mouth, I know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, is just, there are solutions like this, or the robocall system that the school system has that gets out messages that are translated. And, those are all avenues, but there's not a magic bullet. That's what everybody kind of wants. Magic bullet for this involved, but this instead involves a lot of complicated, fragmented work that doesn't rely on one solution. It relies on about a dozen solutions that get you up to about 79% penetration or something. But it's complicated.
So for tools, we've got our Rochester Alert that people can enroll. But for smartphones specific, we have the IPAWS system. It's the Federal Integrated Public Alerting System. The one thing that ECHO is doing is working on a statewide basis to be able to bring in limited English proficiency messages through the IPAWS system, making it easy for emergency managers like myself to be able to send out a message not only in my only tongue, English, but also to be able to tap into other languages as I'm delivering those messages. So it's in development, but it's like Tony said, there's not one solution, but there's many, and that's one thing that's in the works there.
Anyone else? Ms. Meeks.
I'll ask about 911. I've made some calls recently, and it gives you some options to select languages. So if someone calls our 911, and what happens if they speak Spanish, and that's all they know?
They, from what they told us, they have to wait. They have to wait for the, and hopefully somebody will recognize the language that they're doing, using, but 911 center can tap into a language line and get an interpreter online. And it does take a few minutes for them to do. So they do have some sort of mechanism available. Again, it was something that I hoped. We got a lot of suggestions about disaster-related things because those are the sort of things I can control. When it came to the 911 issues, it's really beyond my sphere, and so it's, personally, I was disappointed. I thought, geez, I can't do anything about this. Why can't you throw something right in my sweet spot so I can do something about it? But I think that was part of the learning process for me, too, is you don't always get the responses that you want, but you just have to listen and go from there. At least we're aware of it now. If we didn't ask the question, we would not have any knowledge of this gap that exists.
Ken, I just wanted to add something to that for Sandra's question, and that is, you know, one of the things we did talk about in a number of these meetings is, well, what if we gave you a list of stock phrases that you could use when you call 911 so that you could speak them in English and, you know, they would be able to get you the right person. And there were a number of folks that told us, we're learning English, but in case of an emergency, that all goes right out the window. You go into a panic and you just freeze. And so that wasn't much of an option for them at this time.
Okay, anyone else?
Just a question. Can you have your Rochester alert messages? How do you reach the immigrant community on those?
With different languages. But to be honest with you, I don't. All the messages, most of them, for example, this morning, the ones that were forwarded from the National Weather Service are in English. Those go through automatically. And it's set up that way so that they'll go through quicker. When it comes to other languages, we've not progressed to that point where we have a variety of languages that are available.
Go back.
Kind of to jump on here, but what we see is cultures who are not proficient in the English language, what they end up doing is in most emergencies end up at the hospitals. Many come to the hospital. The only nice thing about having to come to the hospital is we do have interpreters. The interpreters can help. But I think it goes back to Efren's point that the biggest thing is for us to make contact and be out in the community visiting with these groups and being available to them. An example of that is Julie this last week. Myself and a couple of police officers spoke at Park Towers. Well, Park Towers, as pointed out to us, is having a fairly large Somali community. So what we need to do, in talking to some of the gentlemen afterwards, we need to make sure that we bring an interpreter in with us to help us develop and build those bases. And that goes exactly back to what Efren was saying. We have large pockets of minorities or non-English speaking people in our community that we need to work with. The interesting thing, too, is when you look at this, the hazard mitigation, it's not only talking about what do we do with those who are not English speaking, but all the different handicaps that you run across as well, and who are part of the community but have difficulty getting moved around or get to places. So there's a lot of different pieces that Ken and Efren and Tony have talked about. When you start dealing with emergency management, it's a pretty broad area when you're trying to help a broad group of people throughout the community.
I have been cheating while you guys are presenting a little bit and taking a little look at the report here. And one of the lines here, it just says, we suggest finally that a less concrete but equally important step to be undertaken to develop personal relationships with a member of the cultural communities. And I think, that hits really close to home for me, having tried to recently set up a group to kind of communicate back to my ward. Finding participants from some of those communities to kind of come and participate that way is just one. It's difficult from the leadership side too to kind of go out and try and find them. So one is, I think this will serve as a really good primer for who I can probably go talk to about finding participants. But two, you get some of that for free. I'm sure there's technology to solve all this stuff, but this to me doesn't sound like a technology problem. It sounds like a human problem. It sounds like that relationship problem of, I go post on my Facebook page and I'm friends with a member of one of these communities, they do the translation faster than we can get the software together to do it. So it can be one of those, there's just so many ways to come after this problem. I think that's one of the most promising in my mind is, let's go out and build those relationships both from a city staff and as a elected representative level. We'll get out there and do it. So I'm taking this to heart. I'm going to work this. I hope I don't have to use it as a dialing list, but as a list of the people who are great contacts in these communities that we can set those connections with.
And I think the important thing too is to understand that we need to do it now, not at the time when the disaster or the emergency is happening, but we need to do it now so they. The people that we're working with, our constituents around the community, understand what needs to be done and understand our process. When you talk about not understanding 911, that's where we need to try to help, but we need to try to explain some of the procedures and break down some of the barriers. But it's important that we don't wait until it happens, that we need to develop and work on that now.
Sandy?
I just wanted to kind of wrap some things up and touch back with something that Ken mentioned, as well as Tony, and that is that continued contact. And so when we met with these groups, I mean, I kind of teasingly, but in all seriousness, told them, well, we've got this city comp plan update coming up that we're going to be contacting you, so we're not letting you off the hook with just the all-hazard plan. And so as part of those toolkits that we had done and those workshops, all the folks that we had information from, you know, contact information, we contacted them and said, hey, you want to host, you know, one of these things, or please participate with us. As far as, you know, some of the participation we've gotten, one of the folks on the Citizen Advisory Committee, for example, is a guy that we've made contact with through the disabled community, and so he's been attending a lot of our meetings and being active. It's a little tougher when we get to the limited English-speaking groups because we really need to have an interpreter there, and that's not something we have ready access to, but we're looking at ways that we can, as we start having things more concrete in the comp plan update process, that we can actually take things to groups and bounce ideas off and stuff, you know, looking at ways that we might be able to engage communities that way. But they've all been invited to the things that we have done, and hopefully they'll show up.
And I assume you're working with the school district too, you know, mm-hmm. quite a significant.
Yep. In fact, one of the guys that was in the Cambodian group to begin with had been, you know, he just left though, unfortunately, but he was one of the liaisons.
Within this report, of course, you've got the sign-in sheets with contact information. We put those in an electronic form, and so if you need those are available. And for anyone in the audience, I put a public-facing report. Everything but the contact lists are on the city's emergency management webpage, under planning and operations, the all-hazard mitigation plan, and both the Connect 2080 for disabilities and the Safe for Everyone report are on the website.
All right. Ms. Gay? You have a comment?
To support what Mark said, I'm trying to make it short. The experts pointed out that you find that things once you get there that you didn't expect. Mark was dealing with the Somali community and the English-speaking community in one building. Those two groups are now to a point where there is racism in the building, and it's being played out in not dangerous ways, but minor ways. In the same block across the street is a whole host of black guys, some living in the nearby building, many coming from out of town, and the three don't agree with each other. And so it's become an interesting situation to try to deal with, and it's going to be a long haul before we get it taken care of.
All right. Any other questions for Ken or the presenters? All right. Thank you. All right. We have one final item this afternoon, a request for a mobile radar speed sign, and this was kicked off by Mr. Hickey. All right. Have at it.
All right. So the genesis of this idea was the success of the radar speed sign on Viola Road. And, you know, a radar speed sign, it's not an all-purpose tool. It has to be used for a specific purpose to be successful. In that particular implementation, if you're familiar with that road going downhill, it changes rapidly from a 45-mile-an-hour to a 30-mile-an-hour. So even someone who's pretty conscientious, that's a tough transition. It comes up on you rather quickly. So the idea came from talking to the neighbors that are right at the base of the hill on those entrances to the neighborhoods just prior to 11th Avenue. So the intent of that particular sign was to slow down traffic, prior to that 11th Avenue intersection. And to that end, it's been very successful. I drive that route almost every day, and I can tell you the compliance is very high. People really do slow down to 30. Again, you know, quarter mile later, I'm not sure what they're going to be doing, but the intent was to slow them down to those neighborhood streets. And not only from my personal observation, I've gone back and talked to the neighbors, and they've said it's been extremely successful, and they can see the change. So that idea you know, got me thinking, you know, where else could we use this tool? So, and I'm sure you get some of the same complaints in for neighborhood speeding that I get. And in talking to you know, George, you know, it's probably not practical to put a 30 mile an hour sign. That's typically what the residential neighborhood streets are in all these different locations. So I thought of an idea to kind of blend the two, kind of get some behavioral modification. So the idea for this would be, I've got certain hot spots that I've had, you know, reported over the years, so you kind of know where they are. Would be to couple the placement of a permanent sign, so again, this is going to be a limited basis, with a radar speed sign that could be rotated. And my idea would be to do it on a two-month basis. So if I've got a hot spot in a neighborhood, you'd plant a 30-mile-an-hour sign, and then you would that would be a permanent sign. You would put the radar speed sign there as a companion for a period of 2 months. So in that time, people are getting in that habit of slowing down. And the reason this is effective, this isn't just a random boulevard. This you're going to have a lot of the repeat customers here because it's neighborhood traffic going by that same sign, and kind of get modify that behavior. At the end of 2 months, the radar speed sign would rotate, and the permanent sign would stay behind. In that way, you know, making it hopefully a permanent change in some of that speeding behavior. So again, the talking rotating on a two-month basis, so that'd be six signs a year. And I think George had identified the sign cost at $150 a piece. So about $900 a year for signs, and the actual radar speed sign itself is between $5,000 and $7,000. So I think this would be, I'd like to see this initially as a Ward 5 test program, give it an evaluation for 12 to 18 months. I believe it'll be successful, but if worst case scenario, I've seen it work with a permanent placement of a sign. So the worst case scenario is we planted you know, half a dozen permanent signs, and we can also plant that radar speed sign at a permanent location, because I've seen that work, and I know it can work again. That's it.
Mr. Campion.
I recently went through, in my own backyard, the traffic management process that the city has, and I think we lost it by one vote, if I remember correctly, the intent to redesign the street. And the problem I have with the proposal is the signs have been proven to be effective for very short periods of time based on the science that I found, the studies nationally of these radar signs. They're effective for, it seemed like they were effective for about 2 months in either direction of the sign placement. And the other thing they found was the actual just plain speed limit signs have almost no effect on the speed. So I applaud the idea of fixing the speeds on our residential streets, but the way to do it isn't with a sign. You know, nothing, there's really no science that backs that simply putting a sign will ever affect the actual travel speed of these cars. If we double enforcement, I would be, you know, we could go that way, start issuing a lot more tickets at a lot greater cost. Or we could start designing the streets to, you know, maintain the speeds that they're intended to deliver. I have a hard time, you know, we come back and we talk about not wanting to put Sharrows on a road when, you know, and then instead we're going to put up these radar speed signs at probably 10 times the cost. It's kind of disconcerting to me that those are directly related. You know, all these street improvements that we do here are about reducing the speed of these cars because these roads are dangerous, and I get it, you know, from my direct neighbors, let alone all the ward. I can see this, you know, I would start getting grief now that, why is this a Ward 5 only thing? You know, where's our neighborhood on the list? And now we're going to be 18 months out before we even get started, I feel like.
Mr. Ruska.
Well, I guess I like the idea that we're trying to do something.
You know, it seems like everybody has an opinion what won't work and this doesn't work and that isn't going to change anything. And yet, what do we just like let it go? I mean, you drive out in these streets nowadays and it's, you know, no one seems to have any respect for the law, whether it's speeding or red lights or pedestrians or whatever. And for us to sit back and go, well, you know, I guess we aren't going to change people's habits. Just good luck, folks. Isn't the right thing. So I'm okay with, you know, if this isn't the right plan, then let's hear something from, let's have the traffic engineer and the police department work together and come up with some ideas on some things that we can do. Because, you know, I see it every day. I was sitting next to a police officer the other day and I watched two people go through red lights right in front of us. And, you know, I know that their jobs are tough and they've got so much area to cover. But if we start letting people just not think that nobody cares, pretty soon it's just going to continue to get worse. So at least I'm supportive of the idea of doing something, and this is something. And if we have something better, then I'm all for that. So maybe this is something where we have to kick back to our leadership and say, what would you suggest? I mean, how many speeding tickets are we, you know, given in our city? How many red light, you know, violations are we given? Or are we just kind of getting to the point now everybody knows if the light's kind of getting yellow, I'm kind of close, I'm just going to go through, you know? Just seems like the care isn't there anymore, and it's becoming almost out of control. So I give Mr. Hickey credit for bringing up something that at least is an option to look at, and maybe with this we can parlay that into a little bit more effort to come up with something that is effective for the whole area. So,
Mr. Wadger.
Conceptually, I don't have too much concern with, you know, trying it out, but I guess I would say, first of all, the statement that the sign was effective on Villa Road, I want to make sure, I assume there's data there that we can quantify that with the 85th percentile speeds before and after. What did you see with that, George? Do you know offhand, or can you get that for us? That's a county road, right?
Yes, we did like a follow-up study after it been out for about 6 months. We did look at the speeds again, and I'm recalling again, I don't have that in front of me. I think we saw it average speeds go down by like 2 to 3.
Yeah, and that's what I've heard is 1 to 5 miles per hour, but only in places where the speeding tends to be 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. In targeting where we're doing this stuff, I mean, I agree. I found my image here. If you need a sign to tell people to slow down, you design the street wrong. And we've designed a lot of streets wrong that are way too wide for what are needed. And I'm not entirely sure that this is the way to go about it, but we do have a speed calming program that's out there, and I would just, if we're going to do something like this, let's make sure that there is a quantifiable problem in the locations that we're checking, meaning that 85th percentile speed is the 20% over the posted speed limit, which I think is our standard citywide, and not just wherever there's a squeaky wheel, because this can get real expensive and real out of control real fast if we do that. And ultimately, I'm open to doing things that there is a scientific basis to support.
Mr. Bildebeck.
Yeah, I'm not totally against it. The only thing that I caution everybody is that Atkins is gone, otherwise he would throw out the unintended consequences. If we ask staff to go back and look at ways to do things to control speed or look at other options, when they bring them back, then we need to be willing to listen to what they have to say. I would love to be a part of this as well, because I have a number of places in the 4th Ward that are concerned about speed. And an example with 3rd being shut down right now, that's pushing the traffic into the neighborhood, and the neighborhoods are very concerned. I'm getting a lot of calls and contacts about the speed through the neighborhoods. So, not that I'm opposed to it, I think it's worth looking at, but I think one of the things, again, that if we're going to ask staff to look at things, if they take the time and effort to look at it and bring it back, then we need to be really willing to listen to what they have to say.
Mr. Campion.
Yeah, the principal pushback I got from the neighborhood was the idea that, you know, greater traffic engineering throughout the city ends up affecting local traffic patterns. So you get on a collector, and through no means of your own and no development of your nearby neighborhood, that collector becomes the throughput for thousands of trips a day that weren't there when you moved in. And then the existing impetus is that the neighborhood ponies up 50% of the improvement for roads that are servicing the entire community. So we're saying, you local homeowner are 50% responsible for fixing this problem, but you know, your local homeowner generates, you know, 2 trips a day on this road, whereas I can think of a good example. Think Bank is generating, you know, on our particular road, probably half the traffic. So it's how do you, I want to see equitable solutions here. You know, I'm fine. The $7,000 isn't a big deal, but now it's how do you pick out who needs it worse? Where does it start? Where does it go? Like, it, I can tell as soon as the Post Bulletin article goes out about this, I'm going to get 50 emails about, it would be great to have that on our road. So now, are we, is it first come, first serve? Is that how we're doing it? And I really wouldn't support it just starting in Ward 5, because I think there's these sort of problems all over Rochester.
Mr. Ruska.
Well,
then Ms. Meekles.
Go ahead. I would just react to what you said, because why are you getting 50 emails? Because everybody's tired of people driving too fast all over town. And that's, you know, and that's where, you know, I mean, I look at watching people drive by, and I don't try to drive a speed limit, I try to watch them go by, and usually it's because they're not paying attention. They're either on their phones or they're just not looking in. And I think the signs give some awareness and can help them to understand. I can tell you where one is. It's right outside of Dodge Center, because every time I drive by it, I know how fast I'm going, and it makes me think about it. You know, so I mean, I like the idea, and he's asking to try it in one area to see how it works. And you know, that makes some sense, too. But I'm sorry, Sam.
No, it's a good point. I think it's a test case, and I think we owe it to our constituents to see what the outcome of it would be. I, too, have had many, many questions on Elton Hills, and other than making that 4th Street, 4th traffic, just shrink it down to 3 maybe, and bike lane or something in the middle. And, you know, there hasn't been really a good answer, has Mr. Cavill, because it's so darn expensive to do anything. So we do these fixes, like chip seal. You're doing on Elton Hills?
Chip seal.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, probably not the ideal way to do it, but it's a temporary way to make it a little bit better. So I think if it's a test case, is it a small area? Is it just Vial Road?
No, the concept, my concept, was started in Ward 5. You know, and again, with the whole genesis being the squeaky wheel gets the grease, so I know the people that have complained, start with that, and, you know, 6 signs into this, you know, 12 months into this, we'll have an idea if it's going to work. And it seems like compared to other things like trying to double police enforcement versus a $150 speed limit sign, again, if it's not effective, we'll know it in a year, and then we that'll be the judge.
We have one of these on, is it 41st Street, on a kind of over by Watson soccer field?
That's for the school.
Gage. Yeah.
School. During the school. School sign. Do we have any of these up anywhere?
Yes. Yeah, most of these are for like school zones.
But we could test this with just taking one down and replacing it with a standard sign.
As I read some of the staff comments, and I did do a little research also, and I agree that the last thing we want to do is put signs up all over it. It becomes counterproductive almost. So to Councilmember Wojcik's point, you know, if we have some areas where we can quantifiably say, yeah, you know, they're significantly over, because if we're going to make a 2-mile-an-hour difference, I'm not sure that it's all that valuable. But if we can identify hotspot areas where we know, look, people are consistently beyond that 85th percentile, then we can target those areas. So again, I'm willing to try something as well, but also in acquiescence to staff, I don't want to, you know, proliferate signs all over the community either.
And I completely agree. I'm willing to try things. I just want to make sure we're doing it in an equitable way.
Right.
And one of the things is we have this program out there. How many times has that been successfully used? The traffic management program.
Define success.
Has it been used? One of the things I look and see is like, if the, you know, is it that the goal is too far? Is the field, the goalpost too far in that one? Can we look at, you know, further funding for that program?
Are you talking about the traffic tamers?
Yeah, all those like neighborhood that? Traffic management.
Yeah, it was interesting, and you all can correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things we found on that exercise, and that was where we gave speed control radar detectors to neighbors, and they could kind of you can kind of monitor their own situation. Two things we found from that. One, people weren't going as fast as they thought they were. Mm-hmm. In other words, the neighbors thought, boy, they're zipping by 40 miles an hour, and they put a gun on it. Oh, I guess it was only 32.
Exactly.
And the second thing they found is that some of the worst offenders were the people in the neighborhood.
Yes.
I know.
They're so comfortable. Right. They know the road. They're so comfortable. They know they can zip through this sign because there's never anybody there. So that was kind of, and I think as part of that is the reason that the traffic tamers kind of fell by the wayside.
I guess, you know, obviously this is really about safety. You know, I look at, we all have our areas we know. I know 16th Street, people trying to get out of their driveway, same thing as Elton Hills, trying to get out, how do we do this? And I don't know, to my, you know, maybe we, this is where I'm talking about cooperative effort. Maybe, we can create some opportunity where the police department follows up after an area's been, kind of been educated or made awareness there, then they do some enforcement following that, and then it moves to another place. At least we're trying to make a difference. And so I guess I'd be up for listening to ideas maybe out of our patrol division from our police force and what they think this maybe could complement each other and work together. But like I say, I sure like the idea of trying to do something versus just turning our back on it and saying, well, what are you going to do? Throw your hands up, you know?
I completely agree. Based on the study, it's pretty clear that the $7,000 signs are effective. Like, it's clear that those are effective at changing the behavior. So I just wonder if the result is going to be we have to put these $7,000 signs all over how expensive.
my words.
I'd support.
I'm willing to listen to the staff recommendation as well. I mean, I want a recommendation from staff first. If we want to have a conversation about speeding, then let's really do it. I'd be interested in 2nd Street getting the before and after on the 4-3 conversion, because it appears that the changes made on 2nd Street have completely solved all the speeding issues we had out there.
Or pushed them somewhere else.
What's that?
Or pushed them somewhere else.
On Elgin Hills.
That's not likely, but it's possible. And we should be designing our streets 20-foot clear, no exceptions unless the council authorized otherwise. At least for non-arterials. So, I mean, we should adopt the NACO design guidelines. So if we're going to talk about taking care of speeding, well, let's quit building stupid roads then and get serious about it. Otherwise, we could throw money
at
the back.
We have a lot of stupid roads in our community.
We do.
So, where would you like to go with this? What direction would you like to give? Or is this
I'd like to move forward.
I'd support
pretty
that.
Easy.
What's up?
I would support moving forward if we get a staff, like a full staff layout of what our options are. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the options.
And it would be a trial basis, as you say, 12-18 months. See if it works.
Are we going forward with something, or are we asking staff to make a recommendation?
You tell me.
I think you got the staff recommendation.
Yeah, I'm not. I want to hear staff's
take on some. I already know what they recommend. They're going to say these radar speed signs aren't effective. George already put that in the email. Okay. So I'd like to try it. So we can study it, we can staff it, we can talk about it. Again, $150 a sign times 6 signs, and if the radar speed sign on a rotational basis isn't effective, we can plant it in one place because I know that works. So I think we're going to spend more time studying it, staffing it, and talking about it than just trying it.
But how are we going to measure if it works?
Empirical results.
Okay, so you're...
So I'm going to tell you, you can say 2 miles an hour. I drive that Viola Road. People slow down from 45 to 30. So maybe they're only going 32 before, but I'm telling you, it's effective.
So empirical results is measured by staff or measured by people in that area?
People in the neighborhood. So I'm primarily talking neighborhood streets. I'm not talking about putting this out on Broadway.
You're an engineer, right? Like, we have to have some data.
Yes.
To
tell you what, 12 months, let's talk about it again. If people think it's a dumb idea and it's not working, then we can... I don't think we're out much. Again, I think talking about it, staffing, it's going to be a lot more expense than just trying it. And if we don't have anything, if we can't say either way this is successful, then we can just scrap it.
Because I get asked all the time about, like, why don't we just put in a stop sign to calm speed? And all the data says that that's completely ineffective,
right.
And so we don't do it. And yet, all the data shows that these non-radar speed signs are completely ineffective, but we're going to do that one. So, again,
I would argue that I'm trying this in a unique way. We're trying to influence the traffic. As we've identified, the primary offenders are people that live there. So it's not like you don't have repeat customers.
It's the training from the radar speed sign coupled with the permanent placement, I think will make a lasting difference. And if it doesn't, we're out six signs, $900.
I'd sure be interested in seeing if we could get some law enforcement to follow it up, though, because I think then that you create the awareness, now you create the enforcement, and now you've got some results. But, you know,
George.
One point that I think was in some of the emails was that the police do have the speed radar trailer that they put out. Mm-hmm. And they put it out, typically they only put it out for a week or so. And again, they gather data, and then they look at the data, and they do enforcement if they see that the speeds are higher.
That's a good point.
The police are already putting out the speed trailer. They put it out throughout the warm weather months at many locations throughout the city. Again, to take a look at speeding issues. I'm sure they're being contacted by the people from the neighborhoods where they think they have a problem. That's where they're putting up the trailers. So we already have the police kind of doing this. This is a little variation from what Mr. Hickey is proposing here as to what we're preparing the police department already do.
I think what the police had said was their purpose is primarily to gather data. It doesn't stay overnight. It's just put in, you know, a few hours at a time. So I think it's really kind of a different purpose. So obviously similar, but I think it's a different purpose.
And why they don't put it overnight is that they had issues with people essentially the radar going out there.
The one on Beale Road, ever since it got put back up, it's been standing the test of time.
If we start doing this.
Well, I would still agree with Michael's comment that if we're gonna measure the results, we almost have to do it before and after to see if we really did have an impact. That's the metric I'm looking for. With that, then I'm willing to try it, but I want to be able to see that quantifiable. Yeah, we had a tangible impact.
I would be okay with that. I'm so convinced that sticking the sign in the ground isn't going to do anything because everyone in the state knows that it's 30 anyways, and it should be 25, but it's not. But
you talk about the road, you know, reduction on that. That's obviously something that isn't going to be done for some time. It's going to take some time.
Yeah.
If we're going to, and the more it's kind of like the old, you know, popping the gopher, wherever you go, you know, fix one road, they're going to go down the next road, and now you got a problem there. So,
well,
I mean,
if,
you know,
if there's some evidence to that,
that's why I think there has to be some before and after to have looked at. I mean, again, I'm not opposed to it, but I do think that if we ask staff to take the time, we want to make sure we have some measurable means to look at, as well as what they come back with recommendations, and we need to be willing to listen to what that is.
Well, and are we going to do this with our existing sign, or are we buying a new one?
Buying a new one.
$7,000.
So the one on, we could test it, right? Take the one on Joel and replace it with a tent, with just a regular sign. I mean, that would test the theory if we just took the one out of the villa and put up a regular.
Whatever.
Do you really like that speed line sign? See, I think the thing is that we all want to do what's best for our neighborhood, and what's best is to get one of these radar signs. So, like, we're going to have a whole bunch of neighborhoods that say, this was ineffective when we replaced it, I want a $7,000 sign. You know, can we do 50-50 on the $7,000 signs? No, I'm being completely serious. Does that make sense?
I think that would be
the neighborhood traffic program is you pay 50-50 with the city to improve your street. It'd
be hard to get the money from them.
Yeah.
Mr. Quenbold, you have a comment?
Well, I just kind of wondered where you're going on it, Joe.
I don't know.
Lots of ideas.
I only know where one person's at.
How are we going with consensus? I say yes. I don't know where else we go.
Well, I think it's a relatively modest investment. It does demonstrate we're trying to do some things. The reality is we'd like to better engineer our streets. That's not going to happen overnight. As long as we have some quantifiable information that demonstrates that it works before and after, I think we probably have some hot spots in mind around the city that we'd want to try. And so we're not interested in a plethora of signs all over the city. So I'd be willing to support it on that sort of
rationale. What about the permanent signs, the hard ones?
That's kind of the key. If you don't leave a permanent sign, that's kind of the key.
Yeah, that's, you're estimating like a $900 cost for six signs.
Assuming that we don't have to hire extra staff. I mean, assuming these aren't time critical. Like it has to move at 6 o'clock on this day. It's when they have time. So I wouldn't anticipate we'd have to hire additional staff to pound six signs a year.
I wouldn't think so.
No, we don't.
So the way I read the memo, we're looking at about a $8,000 investment to try it for a year or so. Unless I misread it, Mr. Russell.
I just wondered, could we get an update from Police Department Patrol Division on what kind of actions they are taking now? Because, you know, we know the speed trailer goes here and then what, you know, just so we, you know, we're not trying to work against them here. We're not trying to not respect what they're doing, but I haven't gotten enough. When we talk to them, we talk about how many people are needed and what they're trying to do, and don't hear a whole lot about traffic enforcement, and I'm just kind of wondering maybe where we are. That makes some sense to get some of that.
I kind of agree. I called Corporal Gerhardt, and we've had speed signs on Elton Hills, and so I think it would be good to see what their response would be. However, I think the investment to indicate that we are trying to do something is important enough to let Mr. Hickey's project go forward.
The police trailer was $15,000, is that what they said? Oh. And they don't have it deployed 100%, is that the other part?
Well, the $15,000 was, I don't know how many years ago we bought it, but it's a trailer mounted device. So it's not, as we talked about here, something that you would just stick on the signpost.
Yep.
So it's a trailer device. They have a sign that says, here's the speed limit, so they can change the speed limit to whatever is out there so that it's reading correctly. But they also have a special software that they use and a special app that they use that costs $15,000 a year to maintain in order to get reports out of this device so that they can make the reports that says, here's the speeds that they get.
What will we have to do to measure for quantitative data, right? Because I think the agreement here is to move forward if we need a quantitative.
Again, what we did for like the Viola Road one, we have some counters that also can measure speed, so we can get speeds before and after. I guess one of the things to caution on this is that how effective these devices changes over time. So and I think it is. As Mr. Campion mentioned at the beginning, from what he saw in his studies, these might be effective a few months after. You might see some pretty good reductions, but a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, you're not going to see that same reduction. So that's going to play into this. You know, some of these devices, if they're really doing something that people aren't really expecting, people react to those better in the short run than in the long run. So again, if we do this and we do a study after a year, we might see some good results. If we look at 3 years down the road, we might see something different. And that's
by then other roads are built.
Well, as long as we're willing to adopt some of those policies about how we re-engineer the roads when we rebuild them, I'd support this. Yeah, I think this is a good intermediary step. I just don't see it as being the silver bullet.
Do right the first time. I'll go along with supporting it. It's $8,000, I assume, out of contingency. So long as we're getting the data on there, I'm not optimistic this is going to have long-term positive results, but I will, purely out of deference for Mr. Hickey, I will honor him with the $8,000 request.
Wow. Just like my, not like my continuance, huh?
Got a question. If there's a problem with that temporary movable trailer, is it possible to have a speed sign that stays for 2 months and you take that speed sign and move
it? I guess we're talking.
Rather than have a trailer.
Right.
Right.
We're not talking.
That's what you're talking about. You're not talking about trade.
Right.
No. Have a speed
that's more expensive.
Did you say a $15,000
That's the stuff.
That's what
that's
the speed
software
costs.
It does. The police have special software, again, so they can get information out of the radar device that they have on the trade.
And so you go to the Fifth Ward. Mark would review. Mark would indicate what sort of his locations were. The staff then would go out and do some speed counts before we did anything, and then afterwards. So,
right.
That would the
And I think you'd want to take some periodic speed counts, you know, 2 months after, 6 months after.
But you want some before also.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You need a
baseline. Is that what you're thinking of, Mark?
Sure, I was thinking of just doing it. So I think you're going to spend more money measuring it than whatever.
Well, that's the only way you're going to get quantitative results.
I was going with empirical results, but
qualitative, right?
Yeah, if you want to pay for the qualitative results.
Do we, Mr. Bilderbach raised a good point. Can we only evaluate on city roads? What if it happens to be a county road like Viola Road is?
I'm talking primarily neighborhoods. So.
Okay.
All so neighborhoods, what I have in mind.
City roads.
Yeah.
Okay. You can't put signs out there anyway.
Yeah, right.
So, you got a consensus?
Do we already have traffic data anywhere that we can use? Like, if we already have the before, can we just use one of those roads?
We have before data anymore?
We have the counts.
Same as speeding data.
Well, like the Viola Road sign, we did before information. Again, we did after information for that one.
I was just wondering if we could skip out, because he's right, the cost of doing the counts is not insignificant. So if we already have the count done beforehand somewhere, we could just put up the sign and judge it that way.
If you've got the data,
if you have it. That's why I'm asking, do you have the any data?
I just need some.
Well, I'm not likely a lot of data.
I don't know what streets we're talking about here.
You don't have the data for those streets.
Well, right, but maybe we don't have to pick those streets. Right? Well,
we can try for the fifth ward and we can see what, you know,
what you have for data.
We'll see what it costs, what the thing is to come back.
But again, I'd like to hear a little bit about enforcement, because we can tell people until we're blue in the face.
I'll have to address
what the
that.
Speed is if they don't.
Yep. Okay. So we'll give it a shot. Okay.
Can we have seconds? Can we have anything else next? Okay, I'm ready to go. I thought that we adjourned.
And
yes, me too.
We're going to do right. And hence the problem.
I'm going to make
sorry.